The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of October 16th, 2017. On this week's show, we'll discuss Colin Kaepernick's collusion claim against the NFL and whether it has any chance to succeed. We'll also talk to Evan Drellick, the former Astros beat writer for the Houston Chronicle, about one of the biggest anomalies in the history of baseball, the team's 5'6" or maybe 5'5" superstar, Jose Altuve. And Caitlin Murray, who writes about soccer for the New York Times and other outlets, will join us for a conversation about whether the Portland Thorns, who won the National Women's Soccer League Championship over the weekend, are a model for success in women's sports or a non-replicable outlier. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan.
Replicable outlier.
I like that. If you haven't listened to our bonus episode from last week, we did one on the U.S. men's national soccer team's disastrous loss to Trinidad, which knocked them out of the World Cup. You can find that extra episode wherever you usually find this podcast. And if you didn't read it, Stefan convened a roundtable on that failure, which we published on Slate last week. If you're looking for a 5,000-word discussion on the future of the men's national team program, this isn't the piece for you. But if you're looking for a 4,000-word discussion of the future of the men's program, then you should probably check it out. Stefan is nodding.
I endorse it. I think it could have been 5,000. If you want the 5,000-word, we can do that one next week.
On Sunday, a day in which Aaron Rodgers and Jameis Winston went down with injuries and Brian Hoyer got benched by the 49ers, who gave the ball to the immortal C.J. Beathard, Colin Kaepernick filed a grievance under the NFL's collective bargaining agreement, alleging that the league's 32 teams have colluded to keep him off the field due to the protest movement he instigated in 2016. Kaepernick's lawyer, Mark Garagos, who has represented Michael Jackson, Scott Peterson, and Chris Brown, among others, an all-star roster, a real Pro Bowl roster, if I've ever heard one, he said in a statement that, and I quote, "If the NFL, as well as all professional sports leagues, is to remain a meritocracy, then principled and peaceful political protests, which the owners themselves made great theater imitating weeks ago, should not be punished, and athletes should not be denied employment based on partisan political provocation by the executive branch of our government. Such a precedent threatens all patriotic Americans and harkens back to our darkest days as a nation. Protecting all athletes from such collusive conduct is what compelled Mr. Kaepernick to file his grievance. Colin Kaepernick's goal has always been and remains to simply be treated fairly by the league he performed at the highest level for and to return to the football playing field." As we have discussed before, Stefan, and as Michael McCann of Sports Illustrated has laid out in a very comprehensive piece, to win this grievance, Kaepernick is going to have to prove either the teams cooperated with each other to keep him out of the league, or that a team or teams cooperated with the NFL itself to keep him out of the league. But before we get to the mechanics here, let's talk about why he's doing this, what this grievance symbolizes. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, either you believe that they have something here, that they have evidence of collusion. And collusion doesn't have to be very, very clear. And I know you just said it, but it's worth repeating. It does not have to be league-wide. It does not have to involve Roger Goodell and the highest levels of the National Football League's bureaucracy. It can be one owner and another, one GM and another, one scout and another. It's not clear, you know, it would depend on how an arbitrator interprets that evidence, but it doesn't have to be quite as wide ranging as everyone might suspect.
It doesn't have to be like Jerry Jones to all NFL owners, subject line, blackball Kaepernick.
Right. It doesn't even have to be what Major League Baseball was found guilty of doing in the 1980s when it colluded to not sign free agents. And in that case, there was direct evidence. There were memos where teams were ordered not to sign, basically, and they agreed on what players to offer contracts to or not offer contracts to, and teams would share information about what they planned or didn't plan to offer to particular players. And the players won those cases. There were multiple cases, three cases actually, where collusion was proved. Leagues have gotten smarter since then.
You're making me look bad. I said, before we get to the mechanics here, let's talk about what the grievance symbolizes. You're not you're not colluding with me on how this segment should go, but keep going.
Okay.
You're on a roll.
No, that's okay.
You're on a roll.
That's okay. Either you believe that they have something here, go back to where I started, or you believe that he's doing this to get attention. And given that Colin Kaepernick has done absolutely nothing to draw attention to himself in recent months, he has been completely silent. I find it extremely difficult to believe that this is some egomaniacal publicity play.
There's a third option though, right? The third option – so the two options you laid out are either he has the evidence or he's doing this to get publicity. Mm-hmm. The third option is – he thinks that the league is colluding against him. He thinks the owners are colluding against him. He thinks that they're, following Donald Trump's lead. And if they followed Donald Trump's lead, that wouldn't be collusion, according to the collective bargaining agreement. But he basically has no other option. And this is the only venue that he has based on the collective bargaining agreement to try to bring some sort of grievance. It's just, I don't know if like a Hail Mary is the right term for it, but he's just like taking a shot.
He's taking a shot. And then to me, the question is, to what end? He's already alienated or been ostracized from the NFL.
And if the odds
of him getting a job organically at this point are clearly close to zero. Brandon Whedon is on an NFL roster.
Right. The
guys are getting signed left and right. If it were about that, you know, he'd have a job by now. We have been through this. Mike Freeman posted a stat on Twitter. 144 quarterbacks have thrown 200-plus passes in the year that they turned 29. 143 were on NFL rosters when they turned 30. The only one is Kaepernick that was not. This is not, at this point, about his ability. It's not about whether he should have been allowed to compete for a backup job or brought into camp as a camp arm. It's obviously about something else. So if you're from Kaepernick's perspective, if he believes that his career is already torched, then why would he be doing this? One, yeah, maybe to get a shot at getting back in the league. Two, to get compensation from the league for being colluded against and prevented from employment.
And that's all he can get, right, is that if an arbitrator finds that the league has colluded against him, he gets compensatory and also punitive damages, right? But it's not like the arbitrator can say, and the Titans, you have to sign him.
Right.
Like nobody would still sign him or would at least be compelled to sign him.
That'd be kind of funny, though, if the arbitrator said, you know what, Jaguars, Blake Bortles really sucks. He was on my fantasy team. Can you please sign? You're ordered to sign Colin Kaepernick. There might be something even bigger going on, though. And Mike Florio talked about this on Monday morning on Pro Football Talk, that he reported that this might be part of an effort by Colin Kaepernick to get the existing collective bargaining agreement terminated early. And if that were the case, then there's fourth possibility that this is about making some sacrifice for the greater good of his now former colleagues. And that would be kind of a Kurt Flood, Andy Messersmith type move, that you're risking whatever might be left of your career to gain labor marketplace advances, maybe for yourself, but more broadly for all of your coworkers.
So what happens in this arbitration hearing? It is a private hearing, and this was, I think, the most useful part of McCann's FAQ, for me at least. I'm just going to read it in full. The hearing for Kaepernick's grievance will be a private arbitration hearing, not a public trial, although the federal rules of evidence will apply. NFL arbitration does not involve nearly the same degree of pretrial discovery as found in a trial. No subpoenas or warrants will be available in such a forum, and witnesses cannot be compelled to testify upon threat of being jailed. These dynamics could limit the ability of Kaepernick to force the NFL to answer his claims or theories. And that was one question that I think a lot of folks had, is maybe this is a way to just get discovery, to like get those emails, to get that evidence. And it doesn't seem like this is actually a venue where you can make that happen, which again suggests that if they don't have the evidence, nobody in the NFL is going to give it to them voluntarily. It makes it seem to me like a little bit more of a long shot. I guess like theory number 5 or 18 at this point in our conversation is the NFL fucks this stuff up like
repeatedly,
every single time.
Every single time.
So maybe there's just the assumption that they'll fuck it up again, or just at least that it seems like a reasonable bet.
Right. And I think what you need to take a broader look at how the NFL functions and how player relations function. Colin Kaepernick isn't out there alone. He has agents. He is represented by people who are lawyers usually and who have extensive communication with other agents, with teams, with general managers.
That's a good point.
With player personnel directors, not necessarily with owners, but with the people that are making labor decisions in the NFL. It is, like any community, a very chatty and gossipy and information-driven job. We don't know what kinds of emails Kaepernick's agent was receiving from teams. Those emails could be incriminating.
It's a good point. And obviously, the general managers from different teams, they talk to each other in the course of doing their jobs. It's a constant rolling conversation between executives. And so obviously Kaepernick is going to have come up. Will it have come up in such a way that will have been preserved and has made its way to Kaepernick's people? Like that's the question.
Well, and is it
I bet you that there's evidence of collusion somewhere. But will that evidence be accessible?
All it really takes, Josh, is one sympathetic player personnel director whose owner told him outright, you're not signing this motherfucker, to forward an email or an email chain.
But that wouldn't be collusion for an owner to make an individual decision.
To forward an email from another team executive who said, you know, Jerry and Bob we're talking about how we shouldn't sign Kaepernick, or another general manager saying, yeah, I was talking to so-and-so from this franchise and, you know, they were saying no way and we agreed. I mean, it doesn't take much for them to bring the claim. Whether the claim will be successful or not is unpredictable.
Well, look, everyone has said for I don't know if it's years now, more than a year, that Donald Trump said the most unbelievable, like awful stuff on The Apprentice, right? And those outtakes are out there and they're going to get – the outtakes haven't gotten out. Now that's like there are presumably like were a bunch of people there who heard it. That hasn't come out now.
Yeah, there are no NDAs though on forwarding an email from one general manager to another.
This is probably a much bigger – community. It's one where embarrassing information that, you know, information
could hurt
that's
another franchise
or information that's embarrassing to the league has gotten out.
Yep.
Many times before. There's a whole infrastructure around acquiring leaks. There are reporters, a bunch of them, whose entire job it is to suss out information like this and that are pretty good at that job. But it's not like only today is when we want to have this evidence of collusion. This would have been a goldmine for, you know, Jay Glazer, Adam Schefter for, you know, since March. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if the fact that it hasn't come out yet suggests that it won't come out. I think we're just, you know, bullshitting here. We're just guessing. We have no
sure.
idea.
I don't think we should minimize the possibility that the very high-powered people on Colin Kaepernick's side, and I don't just mean celebrity lawyer Mark Garagos, but
are you contractually obligated to call him celebrity lawyer?
I believe he is. I think he's contractually. It's in.
That was an awesome prefix.
Thank you. But you know, Jeff Kessler, the lawyer who has represented leagues and players for decades now and is currently representing Ezekiel Elliott. Would it surprise you that he's been consulted on a Kaepernick grievance filing? It wouldn't surprise me. He's representing Elliott on behalf of the National Football League Players Association. An effort to decertify the CBA, if that were an ultimate goal, would certainly attract the likes of someone like Jeff Kessler and other labor heavyweights. there's a lot here that we don't know, not just because we haven't seen collusive emails, but because we don't know what kind of strategizing has gone on among the Players Association, its attorneys, Kaepernick's representatives, and people like Kessler. And we don't know what fortifications or defenses the NFL itself has legally tried to take in the last few months, anticipating, no doubt, that it would come to this.
The question for me going forward is, Kaepernick has been very quiet. It's been used against him in just the same way it would be or would have been if he was a lot more voluble. It's been used to argue that he doesn't actually want to play, because if he wanted to play, he would come out and tell us that he wanted to play. But what he wants to do now, as far as like where he's taking this fight, is the big open question. He, you know, based on the interviews he's done, he's talked about focusing on working out and wanting to get another shot to play in the league, and also doing social justice stuff and working with kids. If he wanted to go after the league, you know, this would be the first step that you would take if you wanted to be a Curt Flood or Andy Messersmith or any of these the other folks who've made...
Or the Baseball Players Union in the 80s.
You know, people who've made that their mission, or at least part of their mission. And so that, for me, will be the interesting thing to see here, is whether this is like, you know, I'm kind of screwed, so what else, what other option do they leave me? Or if this is like phase one in a very well thought out, like, attempt to take down owners and the league for what they've done to him, and to try to forge some sort of new CBA or work really closely with the players who have come out and said Kaepernick is getting screwed and getting colluded against, if there's going to be some unity there, and not just the unity and the message around the protest movement.
Right. And I agree with that. And I think it takes it to a second level of protest, that Colin Kaepernick becomes the either direct leader of, or a symbolic figurehead of. This collective bargaining agreement has not been great for players. It began in a lockout. Don't forget that players named Tom Brady and Peyton Manning were plaintiffs in a lawsuit against the NFL challenging that lockout. There has been widespread player dissatisfaction with Roger Goodell over player discipline and other issues. There's been more evidence of, since 2011, when the CBA was completed, of brain trauma among players. There is more frustration with owners because of what's happened with these protests. And there is this overlying awareness, as there always has been, that NFL contracts are still not fully guaranteed. And players firmly believe that owners have all the leverage. This becomes an opportunity to galvanize players, not just to protest against social justice issues, but their own workplace conditions.
Before we get to Jose Altuve, a heads up that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we're going to speak with our soccer guest, Caitlin Murray, about the continued fallout from the U.S. national team's more than 4,000-word long disaster against Trinidad. Sunil Gulati, the head of the federation, sticking it out. Stefan, displeased. If you want to hear that conversation, you're displeased?
Not necessarily.
Stay tuned to hear more. If you want to hear that, please join Slate Plus for just $35 a year. If you do, you can get a Slate tote bag and bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. The URL to sign up is slate.com/hangupplus. Also, we need an intern. If you're in DC, if you're free on Mondays, you want to do a little research for the show, hang out with Stefan Fatsis
and Josh Levine.
Send us an email at hangup@slate.com. Also, producer Patrick Fort.
Get to hang out with him, too.
Is available for hangouts and hockey refereeing tips. Email us at hangup@slate.com. We're looking for somebody here in D.C. to help us out with the show.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
On Sunday night in Los Angeles, Justin Turner, he of the flowing mane of red hair and also the flowing mane of red beard, hit a walk-off three-run homer in the ninth inning to lead the Dodgers over the Cubs 4-1 in Game 2 of the National League Championship Series, putting the Dodgers up 2-0 as the series moves to Chicago. In the American League, the Astros are up 2-0 on the Yankees, thanks to a mad dash from Jose Altuve, who scored from first base on a Carlos Correa double into the gap at the end of Game 2. The 27-year-old Altuve, who is hitting .565 in the playoffs and launched three home runs in Game 1 of the Division Series, is probably going to be the American League MVP, this despite being more than a foot shorter than the Yankees' Aaron Judge, who is 4-for-31 in the postseason, incidentally. Joining us now to discuss Houston's diminutive superstar is Evan Drellick, who is the Astros beat writer for the Houston Chronicle from 2013 to 2016, and who got to watch Altuve dismantle the Red Sox from his current perch at NBC Sports Boston. So, Evan, when you were covering the team, Altuve was not exactly the same player that we're seeing in these playoffs. He was a really good player for the first few years of his career, but more of a contact guy. He wasn't hitting as many home runs as he has over the last couple seasons. He wasn't showing the kind of patience at the plate either. Do you have a sense of what happened and how he's transformed from a guy who was like an above average player, like a good cog on a winning team, to somebody who is probably going to win the MVP?
The power spike is not something I have a great explanation for, other than he simply progressed as a hitter. I do know that when he first started showing the signs of power, which is going back to 2015, that there was some concern that he would start trying to act like a power hitter, that he was falling a little bit in love with the long ball, which you can understand a short young player like himself kind of having a newfound discovered talent and ability, it might be something he tries to do and gets away from what makes him successful. You know, even as far back in the minors, though, when it comes to plate discipline, they held him back an extra year, and it frustrated him in A-ball because they wanted him to improve his plate discipline. And, you know, high batting averages are nice, but in today's baseball world, we do have a better appreciation for the ability to get on base without making contact with the ball. So the fact that he's been able to maintain a high average, but also add in the power and the walks, it has taken him to a whole other level. And he's a even better player than he was now the last time I covered him for a full season, which is when he won his first batting title in 2015.
The thing about Altuve, of course, is just his size. I mean, people look at him and think it's not possible for someone that is 5'5" to hit 20-plus home runs or to even make that kind of contact.
Or to play baseball.
Or to play baseball in the major leagues.
Yeah.
He's from Venezuela. Tell us his origin story, because the Astros were outliers in having interest in Jose Altuve.
Yeah, they were the only team pursuing him, and he signs for $15,000 as this 16-year-old kid. And the only thing that was really appealing about him back then were his wrists. It was this quick wrist bat-to-ball ability. So the same thing that has translated and made him so successful is what they saw back then. And you do wonder, though, in today's age, would a team still take a chance on him? I got to believe yes, but this is certainly a product of more pure traditional scouting, which is not what the Astros have become known for in recent years. He was brought into their academy in Venezuela. The Astros were a pioneering team in that country. Teams these days don't have a presence there. The academies that used to exist have mostly been closed, and now teams bring in players from Venezuela into the Dominican Republic. But back then, they still had functional academies down there. And the guy that needed to see Altuve, someone named Al Padrique, who was actually a big league manager for the Diamondbacks, I believe on an interim basis, it wasn't for very long, but someone who had managed in the big leagues, was the guy who needed to get into the academy and take a look at him. And so Altuve was kind of waiting there for a few days, and the rules permit you to do this. And they finally get him in there, and Altuve was willing to sign for free. He just wanted a chance. You know, he kind of comes from, I think, what you would describe as a middle-class background. I don't think he was coming from, you know, a family of no money, but certainly he wasn't coming from a wealthy family, but he just wanted an opportunity. And he ends up signing for $15,000. I think they ended up having a behind-the-scenes discussion of this kid. He doesn't want any money. What should we give him? So they just kind of settled on what is certainly a very small amount. And
let's give him next to nothing.
They sign him, and, yeah, it's right. And he, look, you know, Kevin Youkilis signed for $12,000. So he got more than Kevin Youkilis, but it's a very different story than Carlos Correa. And it took him time to prove people. He's a traditional chip on the shoulder guy. You look at Dustin Pedroia, he's had to prove people wrong at every step of the way, although I don't think anybody doubts him now.
So the thing about Altuve is that, you know, he has the home runs in his game. And we've talked before on this podcast about how baseball is just trending to, like, essentially a home runs or nothing sort of game. But he is, again, the outlier there. He plays baseball in a way that, like, if you grew up watching the game in the early 80s or the 70s, or if you grew up watching the game in the 19th century, as some of us did, he's like harkens back to, you know, the way that an all-around player played baseball. He's a good fielder. He steals 30 bases. He, you know, can slap the ball through the hole. He, you know, can score on a double into the gap to win a playoff game. And he plays the game with a kind of joy that must make I have not, you know, polled the Houston Astros fan base, but I would have to imagine that he's every Astros fan's favorite player.
Yeah, he's got to be up there. I mean, the thing about such a loaded team, you know, Alex Bregman and George Springer are kind of similar in that same hard-nosed type of way. But you're right. As we look around the game now, and you see so many people specializing their swings for launch angle and going after low balls and, you know, more pitchers, everything is kind of being very catered to a very specific approach, right? You know, playing the numbers and the safest bet on every pitch and every hit and the way you design your swing in the off season. And so Altuve is a throwback, and, you know, watching him win that first batting title, it is just kind of this, you know, you're in the press box, which in some way it's a better view and it's not a better view. But I think in terms of seeing the whole field and the usage of the whole field, it can be a better eye-opening experience than watching on TV. And it's one of those few things. There are some gold glove players out there that I would, you know, add into the conversation, but there are different levels of hitting 340, right? There are different ways to hit 340. And I think you're hitting the nail on the head with the way he does go about it. It harkens back to an older time when, you know, Pete Rose, whoever, but, you know, high contact was valued. And now it's the emphasis is on, power and contact when you can do the most damage. And not every L2 they hit is a screaming line drive, but he has this unreal ability to drop the ball in where people aren't and simply to make contact.
And in the bottom of the ninth inning, that's exactly what he did against the Yankees. Aroldis Chapman is on the mound. First pitch is 100-mile-per-hour fastball. And he gets a base hit. That's what they needed at that time. Tom Verducci related in his TikTok about that game, which is terrific on sportsillustrated.com, that he bats 438 against pitches that are 95 miles per hour and higher.
That's crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It has to be some sort of eyesight issue. But I'll go back to those quick risks, right? And you know, we hear about people like Carlos Beltran and the ability to train for high speed. And the more you see it these days, I don't know about you guys, but it almost disappoints me that when I see 100-mile-per-hour fastballs, I'm not nearly as excited by them as I used to be. But to be able to catch up to them and make that kind of contact with them, you know, I in my head, I want to make some sort of argument that, well, because he's small, there's less ground to cover, and maybe there's some sort of, you know, maybe there's some sort of physics argument that would actually back that up. But I don't think you can do it. You know, it's a non sequitur, but I was thinking about it yesterday. In this age where we can measure absolutely everything, I think to some degree we have taken away a tiny bit of the joy. And I'm not saying I wish we would go back. I'm not being a Luddite, any of that. I believe in analytics, but I think when you can look at each baseball game that is played as something of a coin flip, right? And we know this because of all the research. We've known this for years and years and years, but it's sometimes hard to get excited about individual performances. And I think there is, with Altuve, still this inexplicable quality. It does not make sense. And I don't know if you could present me something that explains it, right? Like, why is he so good at that? I don't know if I can give you, or even if the Astros could tell you, this is why he is this way.
I'm looking at the website howmanyaltuves.com, which converts distances in feet to the number of Jose Altuves. And I plugged in the distance between Minute Maid Park in Houston and Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, which is about 7,529,280 feet, give or take a foot. And that is about 1,400,000 Jose Altuves. Just put that in your back pocket, trivia night.
You know,
just
FYI. The Astros fans I found at points, and they have a very, you know, I've covered the Red Sox and the Astros and also the Dodgers, but really in the Twitter era, where Twitter has kind of taken over, the Astros fan base is pretty darn impressive on Twitter, and they'll get on you. And they hit a point, and this is as far back as 2015, where they were kind of sick of hearing about the size issue. And they I don't know if it was a protectiveness or if they felt, this is a group that cannot stand any jokes made with Houston, we have a problem. There's nothing that is hated more in the city outside of Dallas than that joke. But I think they had kind of, they wanted people to appreciate Altuve beyond the hype. But
I watch LSU football, and just when the game is, when it's like a national game, there are just like three facts that all of the announcers say, like, you know, Herman Johnson was the biggest baby born in the state of Louisiana. You're like, all right, I've heard that 5,000 times now. So maybe it's just like, it felt repetitive or redundant at a certain point.
I give them credit for retweeting every Houston, we have a problem tweet over the weekend.
Yeah, there was an account doing that. It was fantastic. I think it's just that they're protective, and it also shows you how long he's been there, right? I mean, him and Dallas Keuchel, those are the two that have actually lived through this terrible rebuilding process that's now paying off for the Astros. So, he's someone who is very near and dear to Astros fans' hearts, I think, more so than some of the other stars on that team.
So we've talked about Altuve's performance on the field. Let's listen to his performance off the field in this ad for 5-Hour Energy.
Jose Altuve is like a great player with a major energy upgrade.
I could use a major energy upgrade.
Then upgrade to extra strength 5-Hour Energy. It's fast, powerful, just the right size, like me.
But if you're here, how are you also out there?
I'm pretty good.
I'm pretty good. So, Evan, when I saw this ad, I think for the first time last year, I thought it was really great that a Spanish-speaking player had this national campaign. And as you can tell, his English is okay. It's not great. But it's like so rare now to have a national advertising campaign based around a baseball player, first of all, and then a Spanish-speaking baseball player that actually like plays into what his attributes are on the field. That gives us like a little bit of a sense of his personality. What can you tell us about Altuve, like what kind of guy he is, what kind of interview he is?
So when I was working on an origin story feature back in 2014 and trying to talk to him. He told me, and I'm still 5% of me wonders if he was being truthful because it's come back up at a certain point. He told me that maybe the Astros saw him on TV in Venezuela and that's how they discovered him. And I said, oh, haha, you're joking. That you're being sarcastic, right? And I'm pretty sure he was, and that was the conclusion settled on as fact in the story. But he is really sarcastic and funny, and this is it's usually off the camera. It's not when you have the recorder in front of him. When you're doing an interview with the guy, it's a pretty straightforward discussion, and then it's kind of amazing. You know, he'll say, "Is that thing off or is that thing on?" And it'll flip very quickly. And he's
kind of a dick. He doesn't want to give you anything you can use.
No. Yeah, I guess so. But he's not a jerk in interviews by any stretch. As some people, I think he's guarded. But
he doesn't show his full personality.
Correct, and I think you see a little bit more of it in that 5-hour energy ad. And you know, one thing is that this just reminds me to talk about nutritional supplements. One thing that did help him a couple of years ago. Not necessarily 5-hour energy, but he did watch his weight more. He cut out certain foods, and it's not that he was in any way fat, but I think he was trying to build strength, and that was leading into that 2015 season when he won his first batting title.
Let's pivot for a couple questions to Carlos Correa. A very different origin story, much more predictable and linear. He was grew up in Puerto Rico, played at the Puerto Rico Baseball Academy. He was a number one draft pick. He was scouted heavily when he was a kid. There was one detail in a piece that Tyler Kepner had in Monday's New York Times about the series that the Astros weren't impressed only with Correa's ability, but with his clear desire to be a major leaguer, that he asked his parents to enroll him in a bilingual school so that he could conduct interviews in English when he reached the major leagues. These are very different kinds of people with very different kinds of baseball backgrounds, correct?
Yes. And in terms of the contrast, you're absolutely right. You know, with Correa, the Astros went a bit out on a limb to make him a number one overall pick. Now, he's probably a top seven pick no matter what. But part of the remarkable thing about drafting Correa where they did is that he wasn't necessarily ordained to go number one. It's not like, even though he so badly wanted to be the first overall pick, that everybody in baseball thought he was that pick. And the Astros took a bit of a gamble. They took him there. They were able to save some money on that draft pick, and Correa was willing to take that lowered bonus because he so badly wanted to be number one. And that in turn allowed the Astros to go out and get Lance McCullers in the same draft. So while he was always supposed to be this top five, top seven pick, there was an element of risk because people looked at Correa, and people still do look at Correa and say, you know, this guy might end up at third base. He's so huge. And, you know, it's not exactly Aaron Judge standing next to Jose Altuve, but it is still comical when you see those guys right next to each other, Correa and Altuve.
Evan Drellick covered the Houston Astros for the Houston Chronicle, and he now works for NBC Sports Boston, where he covers a team that lost to the Astros. Evan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, guys.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
On Saturday in Orlando, the Portland Thorns won the National Women's Soccer League Championship 1-0 over the North Carolina Courage. On Sunday, they returned home. They were greeted by hundreds of fans at the airport. Later in the day, they were honored at halftime of the Major League Soccer game of the men's team in town, the Portland Timbers. And that night, they had their own rally in the stadium that the two teams share. It looked like a couple thousand fans were there for that. Let's listen to a clip from Merritt Paulson, the owner of the Thorns and the Timbers, at that rally.
I'm going to tell you something, and this is not hyperbole, and I want you to listen to this. You are not the best fans, just the best fans in the NWSL. You are not just the best fans in women's soccer. You are the most important fans in all of professional sports. And I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you why. You show the world how a top women's professional team can and should be supported.
All right, hyperbole aside, he's right. The Thorns drew more than 17,000 fans per game this season. That's more than 29 men's big league sports teams, proving that it is possible for a women's pro team to succeed off the field. Caitlin Murray wrote about the team's success for the New York Times last week. She was at the Thorns rally on Sunday night, and she joins us now. Hey, Caitlin.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
The NWSL final was kind of a clunker, but I'm looking right now at the front page of the Oregonian on Monday. There are two stories on the page. In the lower left corner is a story with the headline, "Flu season's here, time for a shot." The rest of the page is a giant photo of players holding the trophy and the headline, "Rose City Revelers." That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, soccer is a big deal here to begin with anyway. And as you mentioned, the women's team sees great support. The Timbers sell out every game. They're at, I think as of last night, 123 straight sellouts. And that's really carried over to the women's team. People care about this team. They're excited about this team. And it's a big deal that they've won a championship.
Part of the reason for that success, though, is a business blueprint that the Timbers and Thorns have engineered. And it starts with the fact that the Timbers and the Thorns are owned by the same guy, and that the front office, as you write in this in the New York Times story, has devoted, it seems, sort of equal attention to both teams, to developing a fan base for both clubs, not just the men.
Yeah. For the women's team, I think that there could be a tendency to kind of see it as a niche product. It's only for families. It's only for, you know, little girls who play soccer. But they, you know, they have a staff of about 130 people. And they, when they had the Thorns join their organization, they basically had everyone work kind of equally toward promoting both teams. And, you know, we've seen the result of that. They're profitable. They've been profitable since their first season. And they're so profitable that they're sharing their profits with the rest of the league. So that is a big part of the blueprint, is having an organization with resources. I think Portland also has a lot of things going for it. They only have an NBA team as the other, you know, big sports team there. The stadium is in a great location. I can walk to it from where I live. And, you know, Portland has supported soccer for a long time. So there are other ingredients beyond just the organization, but the organization helps a lot.
I don't know if it's a fair analogy, but you see this in Oklahoma City, right? Where the Thunder is the only team in town, and they get like incredibly rabid support there. It seems like Portland is the right kind of market for this, because a really top-notch, whether it's MLS team or NWSL team, is going to be like one of the best shows in town every night that they play, one of the like biggest entertainment spectacles. There's not as much sports or, you know, other stuff to compete with. Is there a sense in Portland that not only do we want to like go to this game because we love soccer and we like watching this team play, but that this is like an important pillar of the community, and that there's just a sort of like broad-based idea that we need to support the Thorns and support the Timbers for that reason?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a community around these teams. And one of the other big factors is their supporters culture. I mean, these people, they're not just fans. They are involved when they're not at games. They're, you know, having meetings and creating large banners called TIFOs for the games. They do a lot of events in the community. There is an idea of community around these teams. And soccer is part of the identity of Portland. I mean, the nickname for the city is Soccer City USA, and they take it pretty seriously. And there have been studies and reports that have tried to say Seattle is Soccer City USA, and people here in Portland do not take very kindly to that.
Yeah, I mean, that relationship with the sport goes back to the 1970s. I mean, they had professional teams. The college soccer scene was always pretty vibrant. The University of Portland had a great team for many years. So it is kind of a unique place. But as, I mean, looking at it as a pure business play and a pure marketing play, the WNBA and the NBA tried to work together and still obviously does in many markets, but you've never seen this kind of culture evolve. Major League Soccer hasn't had an across-the-board buy-in with the NWSL. So when Merritt Paulson talks about creating this, that this should be the model for women's sports, I find it hard to disagree. It's economies of scale. It's creating a fan base. It's using the existing fan base for a men's team to attract new fans for a women's team. It seems to make a lot of sense, and it seems like it should be replicable.
Yeah, I mean, we can look throughout the NWSL. The Orlando Pride are probably the closest thing at this point to replicating what the Portland Thorns have done. The Pride are affiliated with Orlando City and MLS. And Orlando City, like the Timbers, they attract huge crowds, one of the biggest average attendances in the league. They are able to share resources, and it's another market where it's not a crowded sports market. They have an NBA team, and I think that's it. And they, you know, their average attendance is about half of what the Thorns bring in, but it's still number two in the NWSL overall. And they've been profitable since they joined the league last year. So Orlando doesn't have the sort of rabid fan base, but I think they are, you know, working toward building something there.
So if you look at the average attendance by team, and if you compare it to last year, it's actually hard to construct a story here that looks good for the NWSL. The Thorns' average attendance in 2017 is 17,653, which is awesome, and that's like many standard deviations above any of the other teams. But like Orlando's attendance was down 30% this year, actually. They were average 6,200 versus 9,000 in 2016. FC Kansas City's attendance was down 43%. They're at under 2,000 fans per game. There are other teams that are around 3,000, 3,000, 4,500. Another at Sky Blue FC is at 2,500. The average attendance per game this year is down 8.5%. Do you have a sense of what's going on there, or is it a bunch of different causes for different teams?
Yeah, some of these you can explain. Like with Orlando City, for instance, in the first game they ever had last year, they set a new attendance record. It was like 23,000 people. So, of course, their average attendance went down when they didn't do the same thing this year. FC Kansas City has had some issues with their ownership. The team moved, and there are some problems there, you know. And I think there are questions about the long-term viability of that franchise. So there are different things around the league. I think also in a bigger sense, you know, this is a down year in the national team cycle. You know, we're removed now a year from the Olympics, 2 years from the World Cup. And I think it would be expected maybe a little bit that in some of these markets that would have a detrimental effect. You know, I think as we look to the 2019 World Cup in France, you would think and hope that you'll kind of see that bounce back up, which is what we saw after the last World Cup. So I think you can explain a lot of it, but the league is only 5 years old. So we still have a really small sample size, I think, to kind of figure out what's going on.
Even though it's only 5 years old, this becomes part of the problem with women's sports, professional women's sports generally, is that the sustainability has to come at some point, and they have to find ways to create that sustainability. So
there have been so many different leagues and so many different sports that have existed for around this amount of time, and there just hasn't been the ability or will or money to keep them afloat. And hopefully this one will be different.
Yeah. And the thing that I would look for, and I'm curious about, and maybe Caitlin, you know more about it, is in markets like Washington, where Josh and I are sitting right now, they're building a new stadium for DC United. The women's team, the Spirit, plays out in the suburbs in a little
Maryland Soccerplex.
The Maryland Soccerplex, yes. Which is a small 4,000 seat capacity, including people sitting on a hill alongside the pitch,
yep.
Which is a great environment.
And they almost sell it out.
And it's grass.
And it's grass.
Grass, at least.
Yeah. And it's fun to go to those games. But as a long-term viable business, I just don't see it surviving there. And that's ignoring that they've had ownership issues and player issues.
One question about that, because I haven't been actually, it's Stefan, is like, is part of the issue there, like it's a good atmosphere, but does it feel like less professional? Like you're not as much going to a professional sporting event just because they're like, it's 4,000 seat capacity, people sitting on a hill. Does it like not feel like it's up to the standards that these women should expect?
I think that if there is an 15 to 18,000 or 20,000 seat brand new stadium in downtown Washington, that's where this team should be playing. And frankly, the atmosphere at the Washington game, Caitlin, felt a lot better than the game I went to earlier this year in Seattle, where the Seattle Reign play in this miserable 70-year-old concrete bunker.
Yeah, screw Seattle.
It has character, but yes, that stadium's really old. I think there's a trade-off there, right? Because if the Washington Spirit go and play in DC United's new stadium, it might end up feeling, you know, cavernous and huge if they continue to get the same size crowds.
But that's the issue, right? It's DC United's new stadium. That's not what the vibe is in Portland.
Right. And I think, in terms of sustainability, two leagues have failed, but this league does have a different model. The national team players, their salaries are subsidized by U.S. Soccer. U.S. Soccer has founded this league, and they support it in a lot of ways. And I think that helps the bottom line a little bit. Teams don't have to spend as much money to sign stars like Mallory Pugh there in Washington. But I think, it's difficult for independent franchises. A GM for one of these teams, Washington Spirit or Boston Breakers, they're scouting talent and making high-level decisions. They're also helping write game day programs. Sure. There's just not a lot of resources there. So I think what I would like to see, people discuss expansion a lot in the NWSL, and it has expanded. But I think a better look going forward is relocating some of these franchises. The North Carolina Courage joined this season. They had previously been the Western New York Flash, and the North Carolina Courage are affiliated with North Carolina FC, which is a men's team in a lower division league. So they don't have the resources of an MLS team, but they still have shared resources. And I think that's a good model going forward. So I think maybe we could see some of these franchises end up moving, but that's tough to do if owners don't want to do that. Sky Blue FC has had discussions with the New York Red Bulls, New York City FC. Nothing has happened. And I don't know if the league can force them to do something they don't want to do. So we'll see.
And it seems like someone like Mayor Paulson should be and probably has been on the horn with owners of MLS teams and NWSL teams to try to explain how they've made it work in Portland. Caitlin Murray writes about soccer for the New York Times and other places. You can follow her on Twitter. Caitlin, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Great. Thank you.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when you did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And now it is time for After Balls. Jose Altuve, Josh, short, right? He is short. Not the shortest major leaguer in history, though.
Wee Willie Altuve?
Wee Willie Altuve. That would be a good nickname for him. Of course, the shortest player in Major League Baseball history is Eddie Gaedel, the 3'7" player that Bill Veeck brought to the plate for the St. Louis Browns in 1951.
Uniform number?
1/8. I'm throwing out Gaedel. Gaedel is an outlier. Statistical outlier.
Fire Gaedel.
Fire Gaedel. All the Gaedels need to be fired.
Out of there.
There's a tie for second, apparently, at 5'3".
Okay, who do you got?
Wee Willie Keeler was 5'4". Here's who we've got at 5'3". Mike McCormick, 1904, a terrible name.
Wee Mike McCormick.
Jess Cortazzo, 1923.
Okay.
One pinch hit appearance.
Cortazzo, the killer.
Bob Emmerich, 13 games for the Boston Braves, 1923. Big year for 5'3" baseball players.
Like it?
Yeah, yeah, batted 083 and 24 at bats. Pompeo Antonio Davalillo, nicknamed Yo-Yo by teammates, 1953, one season. He at 293 and 58 at-bats.
Nicknamed the Lost City of
His little brother, Vic Davalillo, 5'7", was a longtime major leaguer. My favorite name among all of these men, 5'3", Stubby Magner, 13 games for the New York Yankees in 1911, second baseman, hit just 212. In 33 at-bats.
Keep in mind, listeners, that that was not actually an afterball. That was just an afterball prelude, giving you so much hot afterball content this week. All right, so I assume we're doing Stubby Magners then?
That is what we're doing.
What is your Stubby Magner, Mr. Fatsis?
Well, in the aftermath of the United States' failure to qualify for the World Cup finals, I wanted to relive some happier times. 1930, for instance, that was the year that the U.S. recorded its best finish in a World Cup, third place behind hosts Uruguay and runner-up Argentina in the very first World Championship. The story of that team has been well told. Who can forget, for instance, the 2015 FIFA vanity feature film United Passions, starring Tim Roth, Sam Neill, and Gerard Depardieu, which earned $918 in this country, and which we did a synchronized play-by-play of on this program.
The first World Cup will be held in Uruguay.
Uruguay got the tournament, David Goldblatt writes, in The Ball is Round, A Global History of Soccer, because it was flush with cash from its wool, hide, and beef industries. It offered to pay for every team's travel expenses, and it built the 100,000-seat Centenario Stadium in Montevideo. None of the British home nations participated. There was no qualifying. The U.S. was one of 12 invited nations, plus the host, who competed. 8 countries from North, Central, and South America, plus 4 from Europe. The U.S. team traveled 18 days on the SS Munargo. All but one of its 16 players were professionals. They played for teams with names like the Providence Goldbugs, New Bedford Whalers, Fall River Marksmen, Holly Carburetors, and the Ben Millers, who were sponsored by the Ben Miller Hat Company of St. Louis. Slogan? Ben Miller wants your head. 6 of the players were Englishmen living in the United States. The team didn't play soccer together until 2 days after they debarked in Germany. 10 days before the tournament, the Americans were drawn into a group with Paraguay and Belgium. They beat them both 3-0 to advance to the semifinals against Argentina. The U.S. team was dubbed by the local media the Shot Putters because the players were bigger than those on other teams. In an unbylined special cable to the New York Times, the paper reported from Montevideo before the semifinal that the U.S. team is the most likely winner of the title as a result of the performances so far. While the Americans had won easily, the favored Argentines and the Uruguayans faced serious obstacles to gain their first triumphs, 1-0 wins over France and Peru. The experts, the Times noted, had accorded the United States little chance in view of its showing at the last Olympic Games in Amsterdam when it was defeated by the Argentines 11-0. The rating of the United States combination, however, was quickly and fundamentally changed after the first game played by the North Americans on account of the excellent display of combination work by the team. The Americans, alas, were whomped by Argentina 6-1. In the first half, the U.S. goalkeeper James Douglas injured an ankle and a defender, Ralph Tracy, broke a leg. The U.S. had to play with 10 because there were no subs then in international soccer. The Americans complained about the Belgian ref afterwards. Billy Gonsalves said the game was murder. They crippled Douglas deliberately. They broke Tracy's leg. Uruguay wound up winning the tournament. Ha ha, Argentina, that's what you get for breaking Tracy's leg. The U.S. finished third because Yugoslavia bagged out of the third place match. The U.S. would play in the World Cup again in 1934 and 1950, and then not until 1990, and then all the way up to 2014. Who could forget those glory years? All of which is prelude, Josh, to my favorite aspect of the 1930 World Cup, the clothing. The Argentines came on the field for the U.S. match wearing their uniforms with sport jackets on top of them, sort of the short suit. And the goalkeepers for both teams wore newsboy caps during the games. Newsboy caps, it's a good look. Bring back the newsboy cap. Josh, what's your stubby magner?
There is a Twitter account called Sports Paper. The handle is at Sports Paper Info. I follow it. It touts itself quite accurately as sports history as told through programs, photos, and other things. It is a good account. You should follow it. So I came across just on my Twitter feed last week one of their posts, and Stefan, I'd like you to open this link now, and you can help me describe what we're looking at here. This is a cover of a program from the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, October 14th, 1961. This is the annual game, the big game between Texas and Oklahoma that we just had this past weekend. And the image that we're looking at here is a cartoon that is extremely racist, number one. It depicts an anthropomorphized Bevo, the Texas Longhorn mascot, the steer, grabbing onto the long hair of a Native American who is depicted as like red-faced with a hook nose, like a classic offensive American Indian caricature.
Can you think of any similar classically offensive Native American caricatures?
I can, actually. I can. That's a, you know, that's an exercise you can work out on your own time, fans listening at home. So Bevo the steer is grabbing the Indian's long hair. The Indian is saying, "Ugh." And Bevo is holding a knife that very helpfully has what written on it, Stefan?
Scalping knife.
Yes. I love when the cartoonist doesn't, you know, make you do any work. So that came across my Twitter feed. I was like, well, that's extremely offensive. But also, who did that? I want to know where this thing came from. It took me a little while to figure out the identity of the artist, but I'm glad I did. The guy's name is John Churchill Chase. And he was the author and illustrator of a book that is on the bookshelves of really like every New Orleanian. It's a history of the city of New Orleans and its streets, and it's called Frenchmen Desire, Good Children, and Other Streets of New Orleans. So like a pretty well-known New Orleans figure, and I had no idea that he was also doing college football programs. He was born in 1905, and he died in 1986. He had a really long career and an interesting one. He started out as an assistant cartoonist on the strip Gasoline Alley. He then moved on to a long stint as a newspaper editorial cartoonist in New Orleans. Later in his life, he became what is reportedly the first editorial cartoonist for a local television station in the U.S. He worked for WDSU in New Orleans. But we are here to talk about his college football game programs, which were weird as hell. According to the University of Texas website, did this really good retrospective on him that is now dead for some reason, but I'll put a link on our show page to the Internet Archive version. But their rundown is Chase's covers are now treasured keepsakes for his vision of Bevo as the canny trickster brought smiles to the fans at Phil Memorial Stadium in the 1950s and continue to amuse modern viewers who often remark that they remind them of the Roadrunner and Coyote cartoons. So, Stefan, I've selected a couple of classic Chase cartoons that we can look through now. This next one is a cover of a Texas Cal game in Austin from 1959. Do you want to describe to the listeners what they're looking at here?
Yeah, Bevo is sitting on a television camera, and he, with one of his horns, he is writing Texas Victory, where TV is written on the camera. And then the Cal Bear, who is standing upright, and he's got an armband that says Golden Bears on it, and he's wearing what look to be football pants. He is looking into the lens of the television camera, but Bevo
the trickster.
The trickster has hooked his other horn around the bear's neck.
So Bevo is playing on the bear's vanity, and seems like unclear exactly what Bevo's planning to do with the hook around his neck. Would he possibly want to impale the bear
on
the camera lens?
The hook is actually situated right at his temple. So just a little force there would probably kill the bear.
Right. All right. Does the John Churchill Chase cartoon, now all we have for evidence is, you know, an image of a longhorn potentially impaling a bear and also trying to like very racistly scalp a Native American. What, you know, could this possibly be a trend? All right, Stefan, open the next link. We've got Texas versus Washington State. Bevo is pouring a nice bowl of milk for the Washington State Cougar.
That seems like a nice thing to do.
But oh no, the milk is covering what looks to be an extremely painful vice-like trap device.
I think
device.
That's called a leg hold trap.
The cougar is going to get murdered, essentially, is what we're seeing here. All right, let's go to the next one.
It also says welcome to Texas on there. Texas hospitality.
All right, let's look at the next one. This is a Texas Baylor game.
Baylor's mascot, of course. The bear.
What do you see here? This one gets a little baroque.
All right. So Bevo, he's got his tongue out. He's licking his lips. He's holding a barbecue fork, tongs, whatever. On one horn, there's a looks to be a cellar of pepper. And the pepper is being poured onto the Baylor bear, who is sitting in a tub labeled barbecue on top of a fire.
Wood fire, yes.
Wood fire.
The bear, despite somehow being cajoled into this bath, which will bring him certain death, still has the moxie to hold a sign that says Baylor. Mm-hmm. And then here's my favorite touch. Affixed to the tub for reasons that I can't really discern is a sign that says, especially for Dad's Day.
My guess would be that was like Dad's weekend at Texas, like parents' weekend.
So it's sort of a combined bear murder / Father's Day experience. Mm-hmm. I like that. All right. Let's look at another program. And this, he also did the cartooning for Tulane. And so this is one where they were playing LSU. And
this is going to sting, Josh.
It does sting. And so you cannot accuse John Churchill Chase of not concocting elaborate murder scenarios.
This is like a Rube Goldberg kind of cover.
All right. So the Tulane greeny little cartoon dude says, let's see if cats have 9 lives. Now the greeny is doing the following things, and I'm not making this up. He has a noose attached to the tiger's neck. He also has a baby cannon situated, looks like towards the tiger's genitals. He has a knife pointed at the tiger's neck. He is also feeding the tiger poison, which you can tell because there's a little pink skull and crossbones wafting away from it. And finally, there is an anvil that says LSU on it that's attached with like a chain to the tiger's ankles. Will this tiger die? I don't know.
You're leaving out the fact that the tiger is poised at the end of a diving board
I did
over
leave that
the
out.
Ocean facing backwards.
I did leave that out. So this was the LSU Tulane game for 1964.
Tigers have won last eight. Did they win nine, Josh?
LSU won that one, yeah, 13-3. The Tiger just was not murdered enough, I think was the issue there. The last one is that John Churchill Chase also did programs for the Dallas Texans. So he got into it in the pro game as well. This one, do you want to roll with this one, Stefan?
Sure. The Texan is standing on a box of Texan ammo.
It is marked Texan ammo.
It is marked that way. I did not make that up. He's got a 10-gallon hat on. He's holding a what can only be described as an oversized pistol that says Texas Discharger on it. And the
opponent is the Chargers.
The opponent is the Chargers.
So that's clever.
Discharging. The Charger is sitting on – well, it's actually the Charger's kind of a half-man, half-horse.
Right.
Situation
gotta,
there.
You got to kill it. You got to kill a half man, half horse.
Yeah.
We can't have that around.
Where are you going to put the muzzle of the gun, Josh?
Right on the half man, half horse's half man, half horse nose.
Yeah. The Charger is holding a football that says AFL Dallas opener.
First game, already murdering. So that is John Churchill Chase, sometimes racist, always incredibly strange and having
murderous tendencies?
Yeah. Cartoon characters killing other cartoon characters.
I mean, it was the era of, you know, you mentioned Wile E. Coyote and the Roadrunner.
Yeah.
I mean, that really was a thing in cartoons. It was okay to depict murderous behavior.
It's still okay.
Itchy and scratchy.
It'll never not be okay. That is it for our program. I will make sure to put lots of links to these cartoons on our show page for you to enjoy. You can follow along. Our producer on the Hang Up and Listen program is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and to subscribe or just reach out, you can go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. Before we go, I want to let you know about Pinna, which is a new podcasting service for kids from ages 4 to 12 and their parents. It's hard to find great kids audio out there, but Pinna has hours of original stories, children's podcasts, and all-you-can-listen audiobooks, all gathered in one easy-to-use app. Audio gets your kids off of screens and lets them use their imaginations. And Pinna is ad-free, it's guilt-free, and it's a great activity for car time, bath time, group time, bedtime, or any time. You can try it for free. Go to pinna.fm, that's pinna.fm/listen right now, and you can start a free trial. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Baby, and thanks for listening.